Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. The vegetative state remains a mystery in the medical field. There are an estimated 15,000 to 40,000 people on life support in the United States alone. For many, their fate lies in the hands of doctors and family members who still know very little about their condition. But breakthroughs in brain imaging technology have shed light on the brain activity of these patients. Research suggests that up to 20% of these patients may in fact be aware of their location, the passage of time, and their sense of self. Joining us now by phone is neuroscientist Adrian Owen. He has a new book called Into the Gray Zone. A neuroscientist explores the border between life and death. Adrian Owen, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Let's start with some definitions, just to launch our conversation. What is the vegetative state compared to someone who has been declared, say, brain dead, or someone who is in a coma? What is the vegetative state?
That's a really important question. I'm glad you kicked off with that. So the vegetative state is often referred to as a state of wakefulness without awareness. And that's because, for example, unlike in brain death, vegetative patients will open their eyes. They have sleeping and waking cycles, so they might nod off towards the end of the day. They'll have what we call roving eye movements. They'll sort of appear to look in a drifting way around the room, and they'll even grunt and groan occasionally and move their bodies. They'll typically be lying in bed, but they might move their bodies around a little bit. And this is the mysterious thing about them, that they are a little bit animate in that way. They appear to be there, if you like, but crucially they don't respond in any way to the outside world. So if you say, hey, look over here, or wiggle your toes, wiggle your fingers, they won't respond to any of those requests to do so. So that's the basis upon which we assume they lack awareness, but they are nevertheless awake.
And this is different, say, from someone who has had a very serious stroke and is paralyzed.
Well, it actually could be quite
could be.
Similar.
Okay.
So you could end up in the vegetative state after a very serious stroke, or as you said, the stroke could lead you to be in a locked-in syndrome where you would be completely paralyzed, incapable of communicating with the outside world, but nevertheless still in there. And it's important, the distinction you made between brain death is very important, because patients who are brain dead can never come back. You can never recover from brain dead. You literally are dead. That is the modern definition of death. But vegetative patients sometimes do recover. And some of those cases I described in the book, it's rare. It feels miraculous when it happens. But some of them do come back from a vegetative state.
How much do we know about what is going on during this vegetative state?
Well, the story I tell in the book, and this isn't a story about science, as you know, it's not a scientific story. It's a story about a scientific discovery, and it describes how over the last 20 years we've come to realize that some of these patients who appear to be vegetative are actually something quite different. So 20 years ago, when I started working in this field, we just assumed largely that none of these patients had any sense of awareness at all. They were unaware of themselves, unaware of where they were, who they are, and the predicament they were in. But over the course of 20 years, we gradually started to learn more and more about them and discover that some of them have some awareness, some of them have a whole lot of awareness, and some of them are actually completely conscious, but just locked inside their bodies, if you like, immobilized, completely incapable of responding, yet completely aware of every conversation that's been going on around them, every visit that they've had, every decision that's been made on their behalf, sometimes for several decades.
Now, we've learned this through some of these what appear to be miraculous recoveries, but how have we learned that there is more going on than what appears to be going on? It's technology that has advanced over those 20 years, correct?
It is. I would say that the main tool that has provided us with this information has been a technique known as functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. Most people will have heard of an MRI scanner now. This is just a particular variety of scanning known as functional MRI, and that means we can put a patient into the scanner and we can look to see which parts of their brain are functioning normally. And over the last 20 years, we've used this technique to develop various approaches to show us that some patients, in spite of being physically non-responsive, actually, when you probe their brains, you find their brains are responding quite normally. And probably the best example I have is the first time we ever did this was a little over 10 years ago now. We put a patient in the scanner and we asked her to imagine she was playing a game of tennis. And the reason we did that is we simply wanted to get her to think about moving her arms around, because when somebody thinks about moving their arms around in an fMRI scanner, a part of the brain activates almost as if they're actually moving their arms. So we said to this patient, and she'd been vegetative for several months following a car accident, we said, well, you know, imagine playing tennis now. When we did that, the part of her brain that we know is involved in thinking about waving your arms around sprung into action. And then when we said, okay, stop imagining playing tennis, that part of the brain stopped responding. And the way I like to describe this to people who are not familiar with brain imaging is that it's actually analogous to if we'd asked her to say, squeeze my hand. If I said, squeeze my hand and she squeezed it, obviously I would know she was in there. And if I said, now relax and she stopped squeezing, I'd have even more evidence that she was in there. She did exactly the same thing, but not by squeezing my hand, but by activating her brain. And that's how we discovered that she was actually in there and conscious.
What does it look like on the scan? Does the image change? The colors change? How do you know when you look at the scan that part of the brain has been activated?
So this is another thing that's changed enormously over the last 20 years. When I started working in this field, and this is how I opened the book up talking about how we used to do things, we really had just very fuzzy images of the brain that we could hardly make any sense of at all, and definitely not in real time. These days, we have amazing technology at our disposal. Well, the first thing we do is we take something like a photograph of the brain. We call it a structural image, and we get an absolutely full rendition of somebody's brain in three dimensions. I will tell you, it almost looks real enough to touch. And what we're then able to do is to look at that image on the computer screen as the patient is lying in the scanner and say, okay, now imagine that you're playing a game of tennis. And what happens is a part of the brain will typically light up. It'll be a fiery little blob, if you like, that tells us that part of the brain is activating. And the great thing about this technique is that we can predict it. When we know there's a patient in there, we can point to the part of the brain, and I'll often do this in when we do TV shows and things. I'll say, watch this. That part of the brain is going to start lighting up right now. And that's exactly what happens. And that's how we know that some of these patients are in there. And we can even use the technique to communicate with some of them.
We're talking with Dr. Adrian Owen. He's a neuroscientist and the author of the book Into the Gray Zone, A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. We're talking about how researchers are discovering that folks who are in permanent vegetative states, many of them, are conscious and are aware of their surroundings to some degree. Let's just talk about the title of your book, The Gray Zone. What do you mean by that? What is the gray zone?
Well, I wanted to come up with a term to describe these patients and the condition that they're in, and also other similar conditions that the rest of us might experience during our lives. So what I mean by the gray zone is anywhere between being completely awake and aware, as you and I are right now, and being right at the other end of that spectrum, for example, if you're completely brain dead. And the vegetative state is a very good example of that, where we don't really know what it's like to be these patients. But other examples of gray zone states might be Alzheimer's disease, the end stage of Alzheimer's disease, when many of these patients, as anybody listening to this will know, they lose their memories, they start to lose their contact with the outside world. And, you know, the big question is, what is it like to be in that situation? What is it like to have Alzheimer's disease, to start to lose your sense of making any sense of the world? Other things that many of us will experience during our lifetime that I think of as gray zone states are general anesthesia. Many of us will have a general anesthetic at some point in our life, say to have an appendix removed or something like that. And again, there, at the beginning of that procedure, you're completely awake and you're completely aware, but gradually you start to fall asleep, you lose wakefulness, but you also stop being aware of who you are, where you are, and the situation that you're in. And in the book, I tell stories of general anesthesia, and I refer to something called anesthetic awareness, which is, again, is something that is a little bit more common than I think most people would like it to be, which is where patients are not completely unaware during a general anesthetic. So again, I would refer to this as a gray zone state.
So you've studied that as well. The people who are slightly awake, for lack of a better term, during an operation.
Absolutely, we have, and we do this because, in fact, the way we study it is not during an operation, because obviously there's many other complexities introduced, yes, in that situation. But we do take people and put them through the same procedure. We'll give them a drug like propofol, which is a very common anesthetic agent. We'll gradually sedate them while they're in the scanner, and we'll look at both what happens to their brains and what happens to their behavior. And what we're really interested in is, well, is the brain actually still in touch with the outside world when these people are supposedly under an anesthetic? And if so, what is that like? What is it, you know, are you really there, half there, there some of the time and not there at all? What's that gray zone between complete awareness, going about our everyday activities, and complete unawareness, which is where we'd all like to be under a general anesthetic? What is in the middle? And we really still know very little about that.
The difference also between activity and memory. I mean, even if you are perhaps slightly conscious, chances are you're not going to have a memory that you were or what was going on.
That's right. And in fact, this is one of the things that anesthesiologists aim for, in a way. I mean, even if some patients are aware, we'd very much like them to not remember the procedure. And memory is something that we're very interested in, memory in the gray zone, because memory takes a variety of forms. There are things that we set out and we intend to remember. For example, if a friend gives you a telephone number to remember, we have to sort of rehearse it mentally, lay down what we call a representation in our brains. That's a memory that we intend to lay down. But actually, most of life isn't really like that. For the most part, we just remember stuff. I mean, think about meeting somebody for the first time. When you see them the next day, you'll automatically recognize their face. You don't have to say, I want to remember that person. Let's make a special effort to remember them. It's just something that your brain does. And these differences between aspects of memory and how our brain lays down automatic memories and memories that we intend to lay down is, again, something that I talk about a lot in the book through stories of patients who, for example, have lost one aspect of that. There are patients who simply can't remember a face of somebody they met the day before, even if they try to do so. Yet they're perfectly capable of remembering a telephone number for as long as they want to remember it. And this speaks to how complicated the brain is and how these different brain processes all come together to give us this overall sense of being human and being conscious.
We're talking with Dr. Adrian Owen, neuroscientist and author of the book Into the Gray Zone, The Border Between Life and Death. When we return, we'll hear some of the stories that Dr. Owen recounts in his book, some incredible stories of folks who have woken up from the vegetative state and shared their experiences. When All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the science and the mystery of the brain this hour, how neuroscientists are using the latest medical technology to peer into the minds of those in persistent vegetative states, those folks who are awake but not aware, is the definition of a vegetative state. For decades, doctors believed that once in a vegetative state, there was little chance of recovery and that patients had no conscious life. But research and several case studies have shown that is not always the case. Still with us is neuroscientist Dr. Adrian Owen. He is the author of the book Into the Gray Zone, A Neuroscientist Explores the Border Between Life and Death. Dr. Owen, tell us the story of Kate Bainbridge. She had a brain and spinal cord disease that left her in a vegetative state.
Yeah, now Kate is the patient who opens the book, because historically she's extremely important. We scanned Kate in 1997. As you said, she'd had an infection that had affected her brain, put it into a vegetative state. And this was a time, I mean, it was almost the dark ages of neuroscience, if you like, because nobody thought it was a sensible idea to put a vegetative state patient into a scanner. Everybody thought we were bonkers. It was a waste of time and a waste of money. What would we see? Surely the brains of these patients are completely inactive. There's nothing going on. What we did is we put Kate into the scanner and we showed her pictures of her friends and family. And amazingly, her brain lit up in exactly the same way that your brain would light up or mine would in the same situation. There's a part of our brain that springs into action whenever it recognizes somebody that we know, the face of somebody we know. And Kate's brain did exactly that. And that was the first evidence that we had that any of these patients actually had a lot more going on than we could have possibly imagined.
Were you surprised? Were you surprised when you saw that the images first?
It was extraordinary. I mean, I still remember. It's 20 years ago, almost to the day that we published the story of Kate. And I remember exactly how it felt. I really couldn't believe it. Here was a patient who'd been lying for some months, completely non-responsive, apparently with no awareness of the outside world. Yet, when we showed her photographs of her mother and her father and her and other friends and family, her brain sprung into action. It was absolutely astonishing. And in fact, as I say in the book, Kate really started or kick-started this entire field. That result, the fact that her brain responded, really made us all think there's more going on here. We need to really do some research in this area.
I'm curious, what was the reaction of her family to this and her physicians?
Well, of course, they were surprised. Everybody was as surprised as we were because, really nobody had expected anything. I mean, typically when you're told that your loved one is in a vegetative state, you don't really have any expectations. You assume that, particularly once you've been in that situation for many months, you assume that nothing's going to change and that patient is never going to regain any awareness. And actually, everything changed for Kate that day. In the sense of her family and the care staff and everybody around her again started to respond to her now as if she was a person. And Kate's very interesting because she also went on to make a remarkable recovery. And in the chapter about her in the book, I talk about going back to visit her when I was writing the book. A year ago, I went back to Cambridge in the UK to visit Kate to see how she was getting on 20 years after her injury. And she describes us scanning her. She describes what happened after we scan her, and I think her words pretty much sum it up. What she says is, the day you scanned me, I became a person again. And what she means by that is that everybody around her started to treat her like a person. She stopped being an object, a vegetative patient that had no sense of who she was and where she was and the situation she was in, and she became a person. People started to talk to her, to interact with her, and to treat her as though she knew what was going on around her.
What was she experiencing? What did she tell you she was experiencing in that time between when she became was in the vegetative state and when she awoke? Was she hearing people talk to her? Was she seeing people? Was she recognizing people? What experiences did she have?
Well, of course, it's actually very, very hard to know exactly what experiences she had, because there was a long period where she was starting to come out of the vegetative state. And we don't know whether some of the events that she reports occurred while she was still completely non-responsive or during the period that she was starting to emerge. But some of the things that she describes are quite harrowing. She talks about having a raging thirst, about being unable to fix that. She talks about holding her breath to try and accelerate her. To try and actually kill herself. It's in many ways it makes for harrowing reading. But then on the other hand, she did recover. She came through it, and I think in many ways it's a fantastic story of how the human spirit can triumph in really great a situation of great adversity. There was really no hope for Kate. All hope had been lost. The assumption was that she would never recover. She would never return to have any form of life. Yet when I visited her in Cambridge, and you know, I've given her a lot of space in the book because she's an amazing woman. She was there living in her own home. She spoke to me. We had a long conversation. She gets out of the house. She's still in some sense is physically restricted. She has a wheelchair, but she's very, very much independent. And it's an amazing story to come back from being a situation in which you are actually at the brink of death to being a person living in your own home. Semi-independently. It's an extraordinary story.
Dr. Adrian Owen, neuroscientist, author of the book Into the Gray Zone, The Border Between Life and Death. We're talking about how research is showing that perhaps many people are conscious, even though we think they are in a unconscious or vegetative state and unable to interact or be aware of what's going on around them. If you'd like to join the conversation, perhaps you have a personal story to share about this, give us a ring. Our phone number is 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Dr. Owen, you talk about how Kate saw pictures of her loved ones and her brain reacted. Critics are saying that maybe that was an automatic response of the brain, that it wasn't really a conscious response. How confident are you that it was at least a partially conscious response and not just automatic?
Well, I think that's a very good and important criticism, and it's one that we have addressed very carefully. I mean, remember, this was 1997. Back then, we really didn't know. We were surprised that there was any response at all. But you're absolutely right that we had no way of knowing whether Kate was responding intentionally or whether it was an automatic response in her brain, because as I've already said to you, our brain's response to faces is an automatic thing. It is something that our brain just does. You can't choose not to recognize somebody. Your brain just does it automatically. And in fact, it was some years after Kate that some years of developing the techniques and trying different types of things before we could become absolutely confident that some of the patients, like Kate, were conscious. And again, I take you back to the example of getting somebody to imagine playing a game of tennis. That is something that we now know doesn't happen automatically. And I say that because I guess the situation of face recognition, the analogy there would be if a patient were to just move an arm, that doesn't mean that they're conscious, because these patients do sometimes spontaneously move. But if you said to the patient, move your left arm now, and the arm moved at exactly that moment, you'd have reasonable confidence Yes. that that was a conscious response. And if you replicated it, as we do as scientists, and they did it again, and then you said, now move your right arm, and they move your right arm, you begin to build up a lot of confidence that these were conscious, intentional responses. And that's essentially what we do with these patients. We don't just show them pictures of faces. We say things like, oh, imagine playing tennis now. Okay, stop now. Now let's try something else. Imagine you're walking through the rooms of your house. And when we do that, we know that other parts of the brain will spring into action. Eventually, just as you would with moving your left or your right arm, we build up some confidence that these are intentional conscious responses and cannot occur unconsciously.
Do you always ask them to play tennis? I'm just thinking, I don't play tennis, so I'm not sure I would, would I react the same way of somebody who was an avid tennis player? Does that matter?
That's a very good question. We've scanned hundreds and hundreds of people playing tennis over the years, from people like yourself that don't play tennis to actually semi-professional tennis players. It does make a little bit of a difference. If you're a very good tennis player, we actually tend to get much stronger and better activity. But the great thing about tennis is, even if you're not a player, most people know what it involves. Most people know that it's a fairly, and John McEnroe would probably never forgive me for this, but it's a fairly simple procedure that involves running around on a court, hitting a ball. It's not
that's the hard part. Yeah, getting it over the net and keeping it between the lines. It's like golf. You know, it's easy to whack that ball. Just got to make sure it goes where it goes. We're talking with Dr. Adrian Owen, a neuroscientist, talking about discoveries that are showing that some people, or many people perhaps, are actually conscious, even though they are in what is considered a vegetative state. Tell us a story about Kevin. You tested language with him more than just, you know, asking him to play tennis or showing him pictures of loved ones.
Yeah, Kevin was one of the patients who where we started to really try and dig a little bit deeper to try and find out whether these responses were automatic or whether they were fully conscious responses. And the approach we took with him was really in response to his family and other families that would typically say to us, well, yeah, it's fine, you know, we've seen brain activity, but does he know I'm here? Does he understand what I'm saying to him? Families often desperately want to know whether one of their, whether their loved one can understand language. And with Kevin, we sought to address that question by giving him words and phrases to listen to, and we looked at what happened in his brain when he was hearing people talking to him, people telling him stories, playing real words, things that he would be familiar with, versus scrambled versions of that information. And we scrambled all the words up. We made it completely impossible to understand. And we looked at the difference in his brain to see whether, in fact, he could understand language. And it turned out that's exactly what was going on. In a patient who is truly vegetative, if, for example, you were to play them some speech in their native language, in my case in English, you'd see activation in the brain, in parts of the brain that are involved in understanding language. And if you played language if you played speech in a language that I'm not familiar with, say if I was listening to Japanese, I don't speak any Japanese, you wouldn't see activity in the areas of the brain that we know are involved in understanding language, because I don't understand Japanese. And that's essentially what we did with Kevin. We played him those two different types of stimuli, and we found that his brain was responsive to the language or the types of speech that he was familiar with. And that was the first indication that we had that some of these patients could even understand spoken language.
So that means that if you were to talk to a patient in a vegetative state, they would understand what you were saying. If you were telling them about what was going on in the world or things like that, that's what that hope there is, I take it.
That's what we were trying to establish. And again, this was going back 15 years now, and we were really poking around in the dark trying to work out how can we understand what it's like to be in this situation. And back then we weren't really sure what many of these things meant. The reason I wrote the book now, sort of the 20-year anniversary of this research, was to try and reflect upon some of those early findings, to talk about some of the early patients who very much were the pioneers, that these were the people that allowed us to make these discoveries, and try and look back and understand with the benefit of hindsight, what it all meant. What was it like to be these patients? What were they aware of? What did they understand? And yes, now with some confidence, we can look back and say, yes, patients like Kevin did understand spoken language. He was aware of what was being said around him, decisions that were being made on his behalf, conversations that were being made in his presence. But back then, we were just scratching at the surface, and we really had no idea.
Let's go to the phones. We're talking with Dr. Adrian Owen. We're talking about what we are aware of if we, God forbid, we're ever to find ourselves in a vegetative state, just exactly how conscious are patients in that state. And Robert from Canton, you're on the air.
Thank you, Dr. Owen. If you could.
Hi there.
Respond to the EEG ever being used in tandem with a scanning device.
What is an EEG, first of all? What's got some definition? EEG.
An electroencephalograph that shows a flat line, and so they would say, well, there's no brain activity, the person's dead. However, at that same time and situation, has there ever been a scan with an EEG, and the scan may show some activity that the electroencephalograph doesn't show?
All right. Dr. Owen?
Well, that certainly happened. We've certainly done it ourselves. This is something that's technically tremendously difficult to do, and that is to put somebody into a scanner and do the MRI scan and EEG at the same time. And the reason it's technically difficult is because EEG involves a lot of electronics, and MRI scanners don't like electronics. That's why when you go into an MRI scanner, the technician will ask you to remove your phone, even remove your jewelry, remove your watch, remove anything that could interfere with the scan. But it can be done. As I say, it's very technically challenging. And what you've suggested method has happened. And we had a paper a couple of years ago on exactly this, showing that in some cases, we don't see responses in the EEG, electroencephalography. We don't see responses from a patient, but the MRI scanner shows us that the patient is actually aware and is responsive. But I should say that the converse has also happened. And again, we've talked about that, that for some patients, we were able to detect brain activity using EEG, where it was not possible to detect it using fMRI. And the reason why this is important is because it tells us that we have to, in any given patient, try all of these technologies. It's not good enough just to use one. We have to try everything that we have. And
what does it mean when they don't match up, when one shows activity and the other doesn't? What does that tell you?
Well, it could mean a number of things. One is to do with the way that these different techniques measure brain activity. So EEG, for example, is very good at measuring activity on the surface of the brain, but it can't get really deep. It can't get really deep into the brain. MRI, on the other hand, is great at deep structures. It's great at detecting activity that's really deep in the brain. It's not just restricted to the surface. Now, if you imagine that a patient may have had, you know, all of the patients that we see obviously have sustained serious brain injuries, and that injury might be deep within the brain, or it might be on the surface of the brain. It may be that that's disrupting one of these technologies. Maybe the damage is at the surface, so EEG can't pick it up because the areas that we're trying to measure are already damaged, whereas MRI does pick it up because it can get in much more deeply. So that's one reason why there might be a difference.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. Adrian Owen. He is the author of the book Into the Gray Zone, The Border Between Life and Death. We're talking about really the mysteries of the brain, which are countless. And perhaps we're just scratching the surface into the science, but it is showing that some folks who are in a vegetative state are actually conscious, or at least semi-conscious. We'll continue what the implications for this research are and how patients are cared for and some of the practical implications for care of these folks when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the mysteries of the brain. It truly is still a very mysterious organ and how it works. Despite all of the advances in technology, it is still a mystery. But some of those advances in technology have shown scientists that people in a vegetative state, some percentage of people in a vegetative state, have some degree of consciousness. And that's what we're talking about this hour. How do we know this? What the implications are for this discovery? Dr. Adrian Owen is a neuroscientist, and he's the author of the book Into the Gray Zone, The Border Between Life and Death. Dr. Owen, this is 20 years now. That's why you wrote the book, you say. It's been 20 years since there was a breakthrough in this research. How has the research advanced in those two decades?
Oh, that's a great question, and that's really that was the theme for the book. I mean, the book is, as I said, it's not a science book. This is a book for everybody, and it's really trying to describe how much progress we've made in our understanding of the brain over that 20-year period. And I think I can answer your question best by referring to something I say at the very end of the book, which is that, you know, science advances so rapidly, and so rapidly what we thought of as being science fiction becomes science and the reality here today. And I can't possibly imagine what we're going to know about the brain 20 years from now. But when I look back over the past 20 years and the 20 years that I write about in the book, I can hardly believe how far we've come. I mean, 20 years ago, we knew nothing about gray zone states at all. In fact, we didn't even know there was a gray zone state. We thought that somebody was either conscious or they were unconscious. They were either aware or they weren't there at all. And now we know there are many, many states in between. There are many situations from, general anesthesia, to sleep, to vegetative state, the so-called minimally conscious state, even various conditions like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease, where you may not be what you appear to be at all. In the outside, you might look like you've completely lost touch with the world, yet we could put you into a scanner and show that, in fact, you're very much in touch with the world. You may still be laying down memories. You may still understand conversations going on around you. You may even still have hopes and plans for the future. And those are some of the things that we can now detect, not by asking somebody, and getting them to respond in the normal way that we would, but by trying to activate their brains and getting them to communicate with us by changing their patterns of brain activity. And I think that's one of the most amazing things that we've learned over the last 20 years.
You know, scientists can be an impatient lot. In 1996, 1997, at that time when these breakthroughs first occurred, were you hopeful that you would know more about what was going on in this gray zone? Because it's still a relative mystery. You know that there is more, there's things happening, and you know more now than you did then. But were you hopeful 20 years ago that you would be further along the path of this discovery?
Yeah, actually not, because this was a whole new area. And again, this is something that, I wrote it in the book about my life and about how it felt to be involved in some of these discoveries. And back then, it felt like this was the beginning of something new. It didn't feel like we had to understand it completely because, in many ways, we didn't even know back then the sorts of scientific questions we were going to be able to ask. If you told me, if you told the young me in 1997, well, that's great. You've just scanned a vegetative patient and shown that her brain lit up when she saw pictures of her friends and family. But 20 years from now, you're going to be talking to some of these patients. You're going to be communicating with them by asking them yes and no questions, asking them if they're in pain, asking them whether they want to live or die. If you told me that 20 years ago, I would not believe you. I would have said, you're crazy. There's no way that's going to happen.
So your expectations were that we're not that high.
No, I mean, I think I had that initial result, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. I would have never have believed that a patient would respond to a face. Let's try something a little bit harder, and let's try the next thing, and let's try the next thing. And gradually, this is what I mean by, I can't believe how far we've come. There's always something new. There's always a new horizon. There's always something new to discover. But actually, we can't, even as scientists, we can't predict the future. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that's it. That's the joy of doing science, that I know that there's this, we're never going to get to the end. There's always going to be another question we can ask.
You write that 15 to 20% of folks in vegetative states may actually be conscious but unable to communicate. How do you arrive at that figure? 15 to 20%.
Well, we have to do that by doing, careful what we call group studies, groups of patients. And until 7 years ago, I worked in the UK. I then moved to Canada, and a lot of the patients we now see are in North America. And that move has allowed us to see many, many more patients. And over the course of the last 20 years, we've seen hundreds of patients who apparently were vegetative. And, by carefully doing studies of many patients, scanning them all, rather meticulously trying to examine whether the diagnosis is correct or if there's something else going on, we can build up a picture of how common this type of situation is. And it turns out that even patients who absolutely appear to be completely vegetative, even to the most experienced and well-trained neurological expert, if you put them into a scanner, as you say, between 15 and 20% of them will turn out to not be that at all, but will turn out to be, in a way, locked inside themselves.
And it's a spectrum. It's not yes or no, correct? Has your research shown that there is varying degrees of consciousness in this state?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There is a huge gray zone. There's an entire spectrum of possibilities from a patient being completely non-responsive and completely non-aware to actually being completely aware but also non-responsive and pretty much everything in between. Also, it's important to understand that patients will fluctuate from one day to the next. So in my research program, we'll bring patients to my lab for typically for 5 days, and we'll examine them every day. We'll put them into a scanner a couple of times. We'll do an electroencephalography examination a couple of times. And it's not uncommon for patients to vary, that one day they appear to be very aware, very responsive. The next day, there's absolutely no response at all. And that's just part of the natural ebb and flow of life after a very serious brain injury.
Talking with Dr. Adrian Owen about the gray zone, as he calls it, the border between life and death, the consciousness level of folks in a vegetative state. Estimates are that up to 1 in 5, perhaps, have some level of consciousness, even though they are considered to be in a vegetative state. Let's talk about, is there a danger in this, in that it's still 1 in 5, so 80% are not conscious, looking at the other side. Is there a danger of giving families false hope, doctors false hope?
I think that's a very important question. It's one that we spend a lot of time fretting about, to be honest. I mean, I think it's really very, very important to manage people's expectations. And, you know, I've often been, this question's often been put to me sometimes rather critically and said, well, you know, are you giving people false hope? And what I think is we just have to report the facts. We have to stay with the scientific facts as honestly as we can. And, you know, the truth is, as you've said, between 15 and 20% of these patients will turn out to have more awareness than is apparent on neurological or bedside examination. Now, that means that it's not true of most people. As you say, up to 80% of patients don't appear to do that. So for most people, it isn't the case, and people should bear that in mind. We're not saying that all vegetative patients are aware. We're saying we have the suggestion is that most of them aren't. Most of them do appear to be exactly you know, what they are. But what's important, I think, is that every individual patient gets the best opportunity to for the truth to be revealed, and that's important for families and for patients, you know, alike. I don't think just because it's a minority of patients, just because it's only 20%, that we should ignore that. Because actually, as you said in your introduction, there are tens of thousands of these patients around the world, and that adds up to many thousands of patients who might be aware when apparently we thought they weren't. So I think we just have to be fair to everybody. We have to stick to the scientific facts, understand that this is not every patient, but it is a significant minority. There are a lot of patients for whom this is the truth.
I think about the case of Terry Schiavo, the Florida woman who died after her husband fought her family to end life support. How do you view that case? I mean, the autopsy, I think, proved that that she was brain dead, for all intents and purposes. How do you view that case?
Well, I think she's a very interesting case, and again, I devote a little bit of space in the book to discussing the Terry Schiavo case, because, you know, she was tremendously important in a sense, in that she brought this situation, the predicament of some of these patients, into the public eye. I don't think that what she brought into the public eye was that some of these patients are aware, because actually there wasn't any evidence that she was, or at least any good reproducible scientific evidence. And as you've said, the autopsy after her death showed that that was the case. But she did at least unwittingly, I suppose, raise awareness and draw attention to some of the family dynamics and some of the difficulties. I mean, these are incredibly challenging situations, challenging ethical, economic, and moral implications that some of these cases raise, and they can put people into very difficult decisions, as her case illustrated. But I mean, her case also makes another very good point, which is that, you know, this is not for everybody. If Terry Schiavo were alive today, she's not somebody that I would put into an MRI scanner and try to communicate with her. And let me tell you why that is. Sometimes we look at the brain damage in a patient, and you can see that the brain damage is so severe that that person could not possibly be aware, could not possibly produce any responses. And I imagine that the part of your brain that is involved in, say, playing tennis or responding to imagining waving your arms around was completely obliterated by your brain injury, then you're not going to imagine playing tennis when I ask you to, because that part of your brain has already been destroyed. And for many patients, the brain damage is simply too extensive for them to have any awareness, and therefore it doesn't make sense scientifically to put them into the scanner and look for signs of awareness. And I think she was a good example of that. And
were you ever asked to weigh in on that case? Because it was happening right around the time that your research was taking off, the first 10 years of your research anyway.
That's right. I mean, it was very early on for us. We were only just starting to develop some of these techniques. So no, it was. I think it was too early for any of us working in the research field to get involved. I have been asked to consult on many cases since, like hers. And again, you know, the decision I will make as to whether to get involved is more predicated upon whether I think there's any chance of success.
Mm-hmm. Do you fear when you're asked that that you're being used by one side or the other to perhaps give a family false hope or to prolong a life that where there is no hope? Do you ever fear that?
I'm absolutely certain that I do get used from time to time for exactly those purposes. I mean, there's a case I describe in the book of a legal disagreement, rather like the Terry Schiavo disagreement that I was involved in recently, where a family approached me and asked me to scan the patient. And in fact, the motivation for the family was that they wanted me to show that the patient was actually aware, because the wife was petitioning the court to allow the patient to die because she said there was no hope and the patient had no awareness. So here again, we had a family dynamic, pitching one set of members of the family, the brothers and sisters in this case, against the wife in a disagreement about whether the patient had any awareness. And in many ways, both sides of the family were, I'll use the term you used, using me to try and bolster their case. Mm-hmm. For me, the only important thing is the truth. And I think the reason I was prepared to be involved in that case is because, I think if the patient was aware, if the patient had any awareness, then that patient deserves for the world to know that. And this is not really a case of providing one or other member of the family with more ammunition for their argument. It's a case of getting to the truth, and that's what science is about. All we really care about is the truth.
Does your research make the term vegetative state dated? Is there a better term now than vegetative?
Many people don't like the term vegetative state because it conjures up images of vegetables and
it's
other
dehumanizing,
pejorative terms like that. Exactly, and there has been a move recently to adopt a new term, which is wakeful unresponsiveness syndrome, or unresponsive wakefulness syndrome, which better I think describes the situation. And I think that is an interesting term. It's not perfect because it's a bit of a mouthful, but it does describe the fact that these patients, the essential problem is there, that they are unresponsive. And what lies beneath, what else may be going on, is not necessarily clear.
You've mentioned that you hope your research leads to better care for these folks, to at least some sensitivity that they might be conscious and then not just lying there. What do you think, as technology advances, what we'll be able to do for these patients?
Sorry, that was a question. There's another voice interrupting. I can hear a female voice.
What do you hope the future technology advances will allow us to do?
What I really hope is that some of these patients will be able to communicate with their loved ones on a regular basis. I mean, some of the work that I describe in the book is with communicating with some of these patients, putting them into the scanner and asking them questions like, are you in pain? What do you want to watch on TV? What do you want to listen to on the radio? Even, do you want to live or die? The problem is that's very much in the research domain. It involves very expensive technological equipment and a whole team of people who are very experienced at analyzing that data. And where I think this field is going and where I want to take the field is towards a true so-called brain-computer interface, something that we can send a patient home with. It may be based on electroencephalography or EEG or a different type of technique that would allow them to actually reconnect with their families, to communicate again. And I think that's going to have enormous applications, both for patients who've had serious brain injuries and for patients who have had neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
It's an incredible field of research. Thank you to Adrian Owen, a neuroscientist and author of the book Into the Gray Zone, The Border Between Life and Death. Thanks for joining us, Adrian, on All Sides.
Thanks very much for having me on.
This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Thanks to the All Sides staff for their great work this week. You're listening to 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR News station.